Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen. Today I'll be reading a variety of articles, essays, and a poem from the April 2024 issue. I do want to caution listeners that this first story does contain a fair bit of profane language. Dance Factory by Lauren Euler. On the Friday night before New Year's Eve, my boyfriend and I were in line for the toilets at the techno club Birkin in Berlin discussing Buddhism. I'm usually skeptical of Tom's interest in world religion, but that evening I was open to the world. As Tom was talking, I noticed that the guy in front of us was texting, the angle of his neck more than perpendicular. I empathized with the posture. I can get into a messianic mood at clubs and often feel I need to help liberate my fellow ravers from the absent parties in their phones. "Do you meditate?" I asked him. Conversations attempted in line for the Birkin toilets have a success rate of about 25%, some of which must be attributed to one party's desire to join the other in their stall to more quickly put an end to the unendurable wait. But the guy looked up. "Not really," he replied in a Slavic accent, "but I am jogging a lot. And this is kind of meditative," I agreed. Surprisingly, Maxim was happy to talk and good-looking, though a little scary. We introduced ourselves. When he said he lived in Warsaw, Tom replied in Polish, to which Maxim responded in English, sheepishly. "He's originally from Belarus," he explained, "and moved to Poland only recently." "Tom speaks Russian," I offered, but Maxim wanted to talk in English. He considers it bitterly fucked up that he barely speaks Belarusian, which, he explained, is being systematically eradicated in the country. "If you take your high school exams in Russian," he said, "you can basically cheat. It is a joke. If you take them in Belarusian, you take them alone with instructor." He loves to read. The intimidating look, we learned, is an occupational hazard. He's a model. I have never met anyone who looks more like a model, and his agency persuaded him to shave his head. We asked if we could join him in his stall. Afterwards, we parted ways. The party that night was hosted by a collective called Weirdos. I don't make the rules. And like the last of their parties we'd attended, the sets were energetic and kind of intellectual, as I yelled to a happy man on the dance floor. He had no idea what I was talking about. After some amount of time, Maxim appeared nearby in the crowd. "He probably didn't remember us," Tom and I reasoned dejectedly. "One never knows how much ketamine, which induces face blindness, the other person has taken, so one can't be hurt by it, though one sometimes is." "Of course I remember you," Maxim yelled over the music, a hint of relief on his face. We hugged and, also relieved at his earnest display, invited him back to the toilets with us. We wanted to know more about him, we said. How old was he? Why did he live in Poland? He had also mentioned something about Italy. "He is 23. He pulled out a holographic EU residence permit. Protection political," he said, pointing at the card. "Look, it says protection political." "Tom, does it say protection political?" I asked. "Yes," Tom said, reading the Polish. "Protection political." I wanted him to put the residence permit away immediately. He was going to lose it. Like all models, Maxim is not honored to be a model, but is nevertheless grateful for the source of income. He wants to become a DJ and organize parties. He moved to Poland from outside Paris, where he'd moved from outside Milan, where he'd moved to study and fell into modeling because, as a model friend there told him, "Man, you're a model." He moved to Italy on a student visa to escape Belarus, where he'd participated in the protest disputing the country's 2020 elections, during which the pro-Russia authoritarian president, Alexander Lukashenko, who has been in power since 1994, was supposedly re-elected. In response to the demonstrations, the Lukashenko regime arbitrarily arrested and tortured protesters and continues to enact increasingly draconian measures. Activists and rights groups say the government has detained citizens for such offenses as commenting on memes, and indeed speaking or promoting the Belarusian language, which is vulnerable according to the UNESCO World Atlas of Languages and has become a symbol for the opposition. The first time Maxim left Belarus at 18, he and a friend were arrested for working illegally in China, where they taught English to children. He was deported back to Belarus, where he applied to universities in the European Union. He eventually left Italy because he was melting his brains with the Ukrainians he met there after the war began in 2022. They were all so depressed, like really on the mental breakdown, and he was too, for obvious reasons. But they did teach him about music. "You don't know shit about music," they told him, invoking the legendary Kyiv Club K-41. That summer he went to Berlin for the first time, to a club called Eden, and knew he had to make a change. He liked France. The museums in Paris are free and really, really amazing. But although he learned a lot digging in the crates there, the clubs were shit, and he couldn't get work as a model. When he arrived in Warsaw in 2023, he had 2 weeks left on his EU student visa and applied for asylum on the grounds that he'd been at the protests in 2020. Although he's wearing a mask in photos that circulated, he was terrified in Minsk. "Any day the police can break the door and take me to the prison without any explanation," he said. Warsaw was finally a relief. "The Polish bureaucrats were so fucking nice," Maxim said, "particularly compared with those in Italy. They process 5 persons in 15 minutes. In 5 years, he exclaimed as we reached the front of the bathroom line, "he would become a Polish citizen. My kids will have EU passport." What Poland is doing, Maxim believes, is combating its own long-discussed brain drain and extremely low fertility rate by accepting migrants from Ukraine and Belarus. Economists have long warned that the country will need to attract more people to avoid a shortage of workers. Last year, a study by Poland's statistics office suggested that there could be 7 million fewer working-age residents in the country by 2060. Since the war in Ukraine began in 2022, around 1 million Ukrainian refugees have moved there. Meanwhile, Belarus has seen an exodus since the election protests. From a Polish nationalist perspective, Belarusians are the ideal migrants, per a 2020 article on the Polish website Onet. The author adds that the influx of acceptable, similar migrants from post-Soviet zones doubtless has a positive effect on the economy. "They are the Canadians of Eastern Europe," another 2020 article on the website Na Temat proclaims about Belarusians. "They are so polite, they even take off their shoes when they stand on benches to protest. An accompanying photo proves it." Since the right-wing, populist Law and Justice Party was ousted in favor of the liberal, pro-EU Civic Coalition Party last fall, the Polish government has celebrated its new migrant population, even replacing this year's anti-EU pavilion at the Venice Biennale with an entry by a Ukrainian collective at the last minute. Maxim sees the situation differently. What will Poland look like in 10 years, he wondered hopefully. He presented the possibility of a new Poland, a multinational Slavic state in the European Union. Questionable or chaotic rumors continue to swirl that the country's GDP could surpass that of the United Kingdom by 2030. Part of the reason he went to Poland was that he missed what he called Slavic culture, not Russian or Ukrainian culture, he made clear, but Slavic. The food, the forest. While the Polish far right and center left may have radically different views on the European Union and immigration more broadly, both can agree on the attractiveness of someone like Maxim. It was about 4 in the morning. Although the European club scene is distinctly post-socialist in character, no truly good techno clubs can be found west of Berlin. It was weird to be discussing the future of Eastern Europe in this context. On the topic of Slavic culture, Maxim said he would tell us a story when we left the toilets. "I know you like story," he said to me. How did he know? His mother and father met when they were young, younger than he is, while performing the Kozatchok and Gopak, fast-paced folk dances, in a company that toured Europe. He was yelling over the music. After the Soviet Union dissolved, Maxim's mother started another group? A troupe, I said. Yes, he said, a troupe, but it was sexy, not traditional. Soon enough, he said, they were hired to dance at the opening of one of Turkey's first casinos in the early 90s. A member of the troupe fell in love with the owner of the casino. After a while, she took him back to Minsk, where the rest of the troupe was based. At the time, there were no nightclubs in Minsk of the scale the Turkish casino proprietor envisioned, and he saw an opportunity. Maxim's father helped start the first one. He was managing a club in Minsk until around the time Maxim left. This is where Maxim began DJing after he returned from teaching English in China before he could get to Italy. I had to play fucking disgusting Russian music for disgusting people, he told me later. You know, the clubs where people bring in champagne with a firework. One day, in the back of the club, he had a breakdown. He felt he couldn't take it anymore. I was crying and saying, like, Maxim, you have to resist. Stop crying like a bitch. In 4 months, you will be in Europe. The three of us walked onto the dance floor, where Tom and I conferred briefly. What was the vibe here? Were we going to sleep with Maxim? This is often the question whenever you meet anyone at a club in Berlin. But Maxim was too young to be slept with. Rather, he was like our son. I let Tom follow and caught up with Maxim. I'm straight, he said. I acted as if I didn't hear him. In retrospect, it was an accurate interpretation of the accessorial body language Tom and I had just been speaking, which in couples less fussy would have been a telltale sign of a forthcoming, we saw you from across the bar. Later, Maxim told me that he experienced culture shock when he began hanging out with the Ukrainians because Belarusian sexual culture is conservative and Ukrainians engage in the Swedish family, a Russian term from the 70s that refers to a polyamorous marriage. In recent years, it has become a somewhat derogatory term in the post-Soviet world for polyamorous or incestuous groups of friends. My mom told me before I moved to Europe, like, man, you have to know one thing. Ukrainians like to fuck a lot, Maxim said. Only after I met Ukrainians, I realized how it is. Toward the end of the night, we found Maxim again, and he was impressed by the music. Absolutely decent. Who was DJing? I told him it was the party's organizer, Lalsnik, playing back-to-back with someone else. This doesn't sound like Lalsnik, he said, and he was right. I wanted to express that it was a sign of taste and skill that he could identify a DJ by sound, but I was losing my speech. Maxim followed us to the bar, where I felt unbearably guilty, turning down his youthful offer of vodka shots. We smoked. Tom asked Maxim what he did for exercise. He said something unintelligible about Haruki Murakami, martial arts, and the jogging. Grasping for some way to conclude the conversation so we could go to bed, Tom replied, Maxim, you are a really special person. Most people can't stay so put together in this place when they're 23. I wasted my youth filling out papers, he said. As we were gathering our strength to leave, he frowned. Haruki Murakami isn't a very good author, he asked, is he? By 2:30 p.m. on New Year's Eve, Sunday, Tom and I were back at Burgain, getting wristbands for the club's 60-ish hour New Year's party. We went to the main dance floor where the music, played by a DJ named Arthur Robert, funnily, was really good. Almost immediately, Tom had my shoulder, his eyes alight with a miracle. Look who's here, he shouted. Maxim's intimidatingly shaved head. He had been there since 4 a.m. We left after a couple of hours, but promised we'd be back. We went to a house party. The next morning, after about 3 hours of sleep, I woke up in a terrible mood. The friends we were supposed to meet were already back at Burgain, requesting that we bring them snacks ASAP. I really didn't want to go. They sell snacks there. Babe, get up, Tom said, spilling coffee on the bed. It's time to clock in at the Dance Factory. As the taxi rounded the driveway in front of the club, a man in a bomber jacket appeared. Maxim. He was just leaving. We couldn't believe it. We told him we'd definitely see him in Warsaw, where we hope to attend one of the parties he's organizing with a Georgian friend. They're trying to recruit one of the Tbilisi club Bassiani's resident DJs to play in the spring. My eyes, they are shaking, he said as he departed. Next time, he said later, we 100% have to go into nature. The next piece I'll be reading is Redeeming Time by Adam Phillips from Second Chances, Shakespeare and Freud, a book co-written with Stephen Greenblatt, which will be published next month by Yale University Press. The idea of the second chance is one of our more familiar self-cures for a certain kind of despair. The despair that comes from seeing ourselves as saboteurs of opportunity, as fundamentally self-destructive, distracted creatures whose hate is far stronger and stranger and more pleasurable than our love. In thinking about second chances, at least to begin with, it may be worth wondering what a life would be like in which there were no such thing, a life in which every act was irredeemable, in which apology would be nonsensical, every transgression unforgiven and unforgivable, in which mercy would be unrealistic, every mistake uncorrectable, in which revision would be impossible, every act and apparent choice determined by forces beyond us, a life in which losses could not be recovered and conflicts could not be resolved, a life without cure or hope or useful repetition. So how, then, would our lives be different or even better if we lived as if there were no such thing as a second chance? It is an almost impossible question to answer, but it is something many people have had to do. It would be a life spent adapting to an absolute defeatedness, a life of intractable guilt and irredeemable shame. It could feel like a life of radical self-betrayal. It is not, of course, incidental that much of the literature we have come to value is, one way or another, about second chances, about what can and cannot be repaired, and about what that repair might be. Comedies are always comedies of recovery. The very idea of art as representation in whatever medium has within it the promise of a second time around, of a second look or a second medium that can be a second chance. In Shakespeare's tragedies, what is represented is his so-called tragic hero's incapacity for self-disillusionment and so for beneficial change. Tragedies are always tragedies about the violence of self-justification, the defending of an intractable position. What we see in tragedy is the worst-case scenario of the need to be right, life as a protracted tantrum. Tragic heroes suffer from a lack of skepticism about themselves, as though a questioning of the self is an insulting of the self, even a dismantling of it. King Lear and Othello, for example, are furious whenever their actions are contested. They are in despair, one might say, about what their jealousy and their possessive individualism has led them to do, about their capacity for hatred, and about whether anyone can help them. Their demand is for collusion, not for the voicing of alternatives. It is their despair, their helplessness, that has called up in them the faux potency of an irredeemable, murderous rage. In this context, the idea of the second chance seems, to the hero himself, like an absurd distraction. The always tyrannical tragic hero, one can say, enacts his doubts about whether other people really exist or really exist for him, whether other people have anything to add or anything he may need other than their willingness to obey him. That is to say, it is the tragic hero's relationship to help that is being dramatized. And the second chance always depends on the help of others, and so on a confidence in useful and enlivening exchange. The second chance comes out of transforming collusion into collaboration, turning self-sufficiency into a newfound kind of dependence, not unlike a conversation experience to which it bears many resemblances. The second chance often requires the dispelling of prior certainties, the revision of what had been taken to be an essential self. Time cannot be literally redeemed or reversed. We cannot go back to the time before the terrible things were done, before we did the terrible things, at the time we meant to do what we did, whatever the consequences may have been. But the question upon which second chances rely is this: what kind of conversations can our ineradicable guilt make possible or even inspire? Conversations both with ourselves and with others. Second chances are made with words. In the Christian tradition, to be born in a state of original sin might offer someone the second chance of being saved, regardless of whether redemption is assumed to be a gift of God, an achievement, or within a person's grasp. Religions are committed to self-improvement and so to the assumption that the individual is in need of such improvement and capable of it. Self-improvement is not available, of course, to John Calvin's already damned. In a religious context, it is effectively the second chance that makes the life worth living, the allure of being better, even if the criteria for what it is to be better are always up for grabs. The first chance, the life one is born into, is there for the second chance to be fulfilled. But in a world without providential design, chances, unanticipated opportunities, tend to be for atheists. To believe that your life is made of or made out of chances means not to think of contingency as something like a god. In a more secular context, in which the good life and a person's potential to live a good life have been radically redescribed, no redemption, no afterlife, no fixed faiths, no destiny or fate, the first chance rarely feels like a first chance, nor is it described as such. It is only when a second chance seems to offer itself that we can begin to see what our first chances actually were. Chances not taken or recognized, or chances not wanted. The second chance reveals the first chance to have been an opportunity missed, or sabotaged, or simply unacknowledged, and suggests that a life, like a play, is the kind of thing that can be rehearsed. Any sense of continuity in a life, that is to say, any narrative of a life that consists of intelligible episodes, as opposed to random, incoherent change, depends in some way or another on the possibility of the second chance, the repetition of something that can be reworked. People are always older when they get a second chance. The second chance is never the same as the first, partly because it is the product, so to speak, of what we have come to realize was our first chance. If something is experienced as a second chance, it reassures us that repetition is not merely more of the same or simply mechanistic or arbitrary and meaningless, for it is only repetition that makes improvisation possible. We can be the authors and not merely the victims or the actors of our lives. We may not always take it for granted that we will get a second chance, and there are many occasions when we will not. But that we may have a second chance makes all the difference in what we do and how we do it. Tragic heroes believe, wrongly, that they have been betrayed by people they love and need, that they have been humiliatingly naive and inattentive, and that this betrayal is irreparable. They believe above all in their belief. They are adept at radically narrowing their own minds and then remaining spellbound by their own restricted thoughts. A hallmark of madness, the psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott remarked, is the need to be believed. Shakespeare's tragic heroes believe, need to believe, that in love there can be no second chances, that the only solution to betrayal is revenge, usually murder, which will turn trauma into triumph. That disillusionment with the women they love is terminal, leading only to death or murder. It is assumed that they cannot be, in the best sense, re-illusioned, re-enchanted, and reassured again by these women. What we have learned to call pride, narcissism, or arrogance could be redescribed as simply a determined hatred of the second chance. Winnicott went on to describe a developmental theory in which to love is to experience and believe in the second chance. In his version of real love, it is always and only a second chance, and so real love, or at least real exchange between people, in his sense of real, can only come out of a gradual disillusionment with oneself and the other person. It is the product of a supposed betrayal. The child, says Winnicott, betrays his or her parents and endangers him or herself by hating them, the people the child loves and needs, and thus the child's ambivalence, the child's love and hate, are a threat to his or her well-being. The parent betrays the child by becoming a real person to the child, not merely a wish for a person, nor a figure of fantasy, exclusively meeting the child's needs. Parents are inevitably ambivalent about their own children. Oedipus Rex, after all, is also a story about the murderous wishes of parents in relation to their children. In Winnicott's story of child development, the inevitability of things going wrong initially between parents and children, and eventually between adults in their various relationships, is taken for granted, with everything depending on how things are repaired and whether they can be repaired. Reparation is another word for the second chance. In these tragedies, there is despair about the possibility of repair, of the second chance that is a making of amends, a making up in the fullest sense. For Winnicott, love is an endless and ongoing process of illusionment and disillusionment, a falling in and out of love that is the definition of love as something that develops and deepens, a repeated and cumulative and precarious cycle of first and second chances that can at any moment be sabotaged. For Winnicott, illusionment, falling in love, without the subsequent disillusionment, disappointment, is disengaged and futile and enraged. And the disillusionment that does not lead to a future re-illusionment, a re-enchantment, forecloses development. Shakespeare's late plays, one could say, are about ways of surviving disillusionment. In most dramas, and in all psychoanalytic treatments, the story begins with something going wrong. In Shakespearean tragedies, unlike the late romances, repair is preempted and displaced by revenge, the repetition compulsion at its most extreme and destructive, seeming to be the alternative to and the refusal of reparation. The escalation of violence preferred to the understanding of what might have prompted it. Revenge always forecloses the possibility of new experience, of discovery. Should we then choose revenge, which is always more of the same, or a second chance, which is not? What is it that can be more alluring, more tempting, more satisfying about revenge? What can abolish second, more conciliatory thoughts? If conflict between people is taken to be unavoidable, taken to be the point, not the problem, as it is in Shakespearean drama and Freudian psychoanalysis, then the question will always be, what, if any, kind of second chance can come out of any given conflict? Or, to put it differently, what is the desire for a life without second chances a desire for? You are listening to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Next, I'll be reading Children for Sale, When Guatemalan Adoption Became Big Business, by John Washington. Discussed in this essay, Until I Find You, Disappeared Children and Coercive Adoptions in Guatemala, by Rachel Nolan, Harvard University Press, 320 pages, $35. In May 1982, Blanca Luz Lopez entrusted her son, a toddler, to a full-time caretaker in a poor neighborhood of Guatemala City. This was a common arrangement for working mothers, like Lopez, whose long hours prevented them from assuming themselves the responsibilities of parenting. She visited her son when she could, and then, one day, that next February, he wasn't there. The caretaker said she had sent the boy elsewhere for his greater safety and gave Lopez an address. Lopez went to the house, and a woman there told her that the boy would be returned to her at a piñata party so that he could be given a proper goodbye. When Lopez and four other people, three adults and a child, arrived for the party, they were shown in, offered a bottle of liquor, and then set upon by a group of attackers with knives. All four adults, including Lopez, were murdered, and the child was kidnapped. The assailants had already shuttled Lopez's son out of the country, and the other child was never seen again. To this day, neither has been found. Before Guatemala outlawed foreign adoptions in 2007, 1 in 100 children born there was adopted internationally. The country was second only to China in the number of children being sent abroad, yet Guatemala had a population of about 13.5 million people, roughly 1/100th of China's. Rachel Nolan, in her detailed and heartrending first book, Until I Find You, Disappeared Children and Coercive Adoptions in Guatemala, uses years of research to show the way that a country destabilized by war can invite merciless profiteers to break apart families such as Lopez's and allow others overseas to reconfigure them according to their own desires. For the 3 decades between 1977 and 2007, Guatemala allowed lawyers to match children with foreign families with minimal oversight from a court. What happened in Guatemala, along with similar scandals in Romania, South Korea, and Peru, inspired the creation of the Hague Convention on Inter-Country Adoption in 1993. The treaty now governs the way more than 100 countries conduct adoption across national borders. Nolan has written in these and other pages on Latin America and its literatures for years, blending original reportage with detailed history and astute analysis. She often drops anchor in situations that have been reduced, especially in the United States, to talking points, such as the malefic cartels of Mexico. With Until I Find You, Nolan uses the adoption scandal to, among other things, distill the complexities of the Guatemalan Civil War of 1960 to 1996. This was a less evenly matched conflict than generally implied by the term civil war. Rather, it consisted of the government slaughter of leftists and indigenous insurgents, as well as thousands of citizens. The conflict had its origins in a CIA-backed coup in 1954 and was prolonged by U.S. support for Guatemalan governments. Nolan dissects the country's recent history without succumbing to the sanitizing impulse of much academic prose and without overdramatizing what could easily be maudlin, babies whisked away from families and disappeared into distant lands, while often initiated with the best of intentions in wealthier countries, Nolan writes. International adoptions were the result of immiseration in sender countries, where they were bound up in violent conflicts over politics, local racial divisions, and enforcing often misogynistic ideas about the role and place of women. And some, of course, did not have the best of intentions. In the United States today, if you want to adopt a child using the Hague Convention process, you must choose an accredited adoption agency and have your home inspected by a social worker. Then you file an application with United States Citizenship and Immigration Services and prepare a dossier of documents for the foreign country. Only after taking these steps can you be matched with a child. Once you match, you apply again to USCIS for a provisional approval to go ahead. If approval is granted, you begin additional legal proceedings in the child's country of origin. Finally, you are invited to pick up your child in their home country and report to the local U.S. Embassy for a visa interview, which, if successful, will allow you to bring the child to the United States. The process can take 1.5 to 4 years and can cost between $20,000 and $50,000. By contrast, adopting a child through the U.S. foster care system can cost as little as $2,700. Birth parents must relinquish their children freely, and they cannot be paid. From 1999 to 2007, about 30,000 children, many of them indigenous or from families in extreme poverty, were adopted out of Guatemala, with more than three-quarters of these kids going to the United States. Adoptions ramped up after the 1976 earthquake, or class quake, as Nolan and others refer to it, which killed an estimated 23,000 people in the country. The response to the disaster laid bare social inequalities and prompted coverage of an orphan crisis, she writes. In its aftermath, the Guatemalan state collapsed, and international humanitarian agencies, many of them evangelical Christian in character, stepped in. One of the proposed solutions to the huge number of orphans was a law that privatized adoptions. While state-run adoptions took years to complete, private ones could be wrapped up in a few months. Costs for adoptive parents grew from a few $1,000s in the 80s to almost $60,000 in the late 90s in today's dollars. Lawyers earned $4,000 from a $20,000 international adoption, whereas birth parents were compensated the least. One Mayan Tiotusha speaking mother said that she was offered $40 and bus fare to give up her son. As foreign demand rose and the revolutionary notion of a child's right to remain with their birth family was suppressed, Nolan writes, the principle of the best interests of the child was defined in a straightforward way: material wealth. As with much of the global South, permanent international adoption came to supersede older, informal modes of mutual aid. Personal struggles, including with child care, are shared by the community. But coerced adoptions only accelerate the dissolution of existing support systems. A textbook example of how colonial logic disrupts perfectly functional societies. Blame for children being transferred abroad, if cast at all, almost always landed on mothers. They were often called madres denaturalizadas, or denatured mothers, by journalists. Enabled by privatization, lawyers began working with baby brokers, or jaladuras, pullers, who were paid to locate adoptable children. A jaladura would spot poor, typically indigenous pregnant women at home, at bus stops, in hospitals, or in marketplaces, and sell them on giving up their children. Some jaladuras, Nolan writes, carried photo albums and flipped through them with pregnant women, showing them Guatemalan boys and girls in comfortable middle-class families abroad. One photo of an adoptive family in America featured wall-to-wall carpet and a piano. As if there was something out of the Brothers Grimm, some pregnant women were subjected to casas de engorde, fattening houses, where jaladuras would keep them until the adoption was finalized. Justifications for these tactics, as well as less villainous ones, varied. As Susana Luarca Saracho, a lawyer who worked with jaladuras and later went to jail for child trafficking and falsifying adoption papers, put it to the New York Times in 2006. Which would a child prefer, to grow up in misery or to go to the United States where there is everything? Yes, there was and is instability in Guatemala, but there is also culture, language, 22 Mayan tongues at last count, family, the implied nothing that nonetheless makes a place a home. Private adoptions rose during Guatemala's most violent years. Nolan's book contributes to the historiography of the multi-decade conflict, which has already been the focus of some excellent scholarship by such specialists as Greg Grandin, Victoria Sanford, and Stephen Schlesinger. But the war in the country remained poorly understood in the United States. About 200,000 Guatemalans died in the conflict. An estimated 45,000 people were also disappeared, about 5,000 of whom were children. At least 500, which Nolan thinks is a substantial undercount of the disappeared children, were put up for adoption. And yet, it would be wrong to count since each child is not just an individual, but surrounded by a web of family and community, as Nolan writes. Numbers fail to convey the tearing of the entire social fabric around the forced disappearance of a child. I can attest to those tears in the fabric. My great uncle Toma was disappeared from a small central Romanian village in the 1950s when he was a teenager. All my life, I have listened as my family members talked around the event but found themselves pulled in as if by an emotional black hole. In our case, at least, there was a reunion. A decade after Toma's disappearance, he came back. In the intervening years, he'd been jailed, tortured, and forced to work in grueling conditions, but he had survived. Though my grandmother, his sister-in-law, now lives in rural Ohio, she is still scared of the Securitate, the secret police force, which was disbanded in 1989. She was also adopted as a child and didn't know who her biological mother was until she was nearly 10. She met her biological father only once as an adult. As in Guatemala, the accumulation of steep economic inequality, political persecution, and forced migration affected many Romanian families. Mine, though split, has stitched itself back together. Still, when I look at my 4-year-old son, I sometimes remember a rupture I never lived. Nolan's book centers on Guatemala, but in its broadest stroke, she writes, the story resembles that of many countries where indigenous children have been separated from their families, where people have preyed on birth mothers to profit from commercial adoptions, or where families have struggled to keep and raise their children in the face of mass violence, untenable economic pressures, and unfreedom for women. Native Americans in the United States, First Nation kids in Canada, and Aboriginal children in Australia, not to mention the children who were disappeared in Nazi Germany, Francoist Spain, and Argentina during the 1976 through 1983 dictatorship, had been subject to illegal adoption, but Guatemala was notable for the way, as Nolan puts it, that colonial and Cold War violence marched lockstep. When, in 2013, the country's former dictator, Efrain Rios Montt, was tried for genocide in Guatemala City, adoption records were used as part of the case against him. Since 1948, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group has become one of the United Nations' criteria for classifying crimes as genocide. More than 3 decades of violence not only increased humanitarian adoptions in Guatemala, but set off a wave of emigration that continues today. While extremely high unemployment in the 80s accelerated a trend of Guatemalan men fleeing north on their own, whole Guatemalan families now migrate, and children increasingly attempt the journey alone. Though they may no longer be spirited away by philanthropic institutions, they are now forced out by a perilous combination of extreme poverty, climate change, and violence. In December 2018, 2 Guatemalan children, 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso and 7-year-old Jacqueline Kalmakin, died while in U.S. custody. In 2022, according to the New York Times, more than 60,000 children from Guatemala crossed the U.S.-Mexico border without their parents. Many end up with relatives in the United States, but others land with unrelated sponsors. Little is known of their circumstances. After years of teetering on the brink of state collapse, there has been recent cause for hope in Guatemala, with the election of Bernardo Arevalo as president last August. One of his opponents in the presidential race, Edmond Mulet, was arrested in the 80s for falsifying adoption paperwork. Arevalo's father, Juan José Arevalo, served from 1945 until 1951 as the country's first democratically elected leader. Arevalo's mother, Elisa Martinez Contreras, instituted programs that prioritize the rights of families and communities. If Arevalo isn't forced out by a judicial system seeking to undermine him at every turn, he may be able to continue reuniting Guatemalan families as well as the country as a whole. On January 14th, The day he was due to be sworn in, reactionary lawmakers attempted a coup, delaying his inauguration by 9 hours. Arevalo took office with the support of the Biden administration, whose State Department officials had spent months strong-arming business leaders and had imposed visa restrictions on two-thirds of Guatemala's Congress. Arevalo inherits a country in which legal adoption routes are still closed to foreigners and abortion remains illegal, with the sole exception being to save the life of the mother. Same-sex marriage is outlawed, and LGBTQI people routinely suffer persecution. The lives, rights, and identities of Guatemalan children remain in peril, so it's not surprising that many Guatemalans want their children to grow up in the United States. Once asylum seekers get to the U.S.-Mexico border, they are faced with a choice: wait months for an official appointment or submit themselves to human smugglers. For those families who decide that languishing in a border town, trekking the desert, or fording the river is too dangerous, there's another option: sending their children to the United States alone. A slew of anti-immigrant policies created by Trump, but hardly disturbed by Biden, has made it more difficult for many asylum seekers to claim protection. But border officials will take unaccompanied minors into custody and begin processing their claims immediately. The setup has created an impossible bind. If parents relinquish their children, knowing they might not see them again, they may save their lives. Consequently, from September to November of last year, the number of minors showing up in Nogales, just one port of entry, almost tripled from 50 to 140. Pedro de Velasco, an advocate for migrants' rights who works at the Kino Border Initiative, told me in February. I've spoken with a number of families, some from Guatemala, who've struggled with this decision, if decision is the right word in such a situation. Lawsuits have forced the U.S. government to try to reunite some of the families they pulled apart during the family separation crisis, and they have returned more than 700 children to their parents. But reunion, as one can see from the example of Guatemala, is not the same as repair. "I felt like I was foundationless," said Gemma Givens, who located her Guatemalan birth mother at the age of 20 after being brought to the Bay Area at 4 months old. "I was floating, or I was a ghost. Whose face do I have?" One Guatemalan organization, La Liga, has helped at least 527 families find children who went missing during the war. Thousands more remain in the dark. John Washington is a translator and a staff reporter at Arizona Luminaria. The Case for Open Borders was published in February by Haymarket Books. Now, for a change of pace, I'm going to read a poem titled Village of Dolls by Catherine Barnett from Solutions for the Problem of Bodies in Space, which will be published next month by Grey Wolf Press. "Some people say Tsukimi Ayano makes her life-size dolls out of loneliness. I don't know what material she uses, foam, horsehair, or where the clothes come from, the hats. She was born in Nagoro, moved away, came back, to a village with only 30-some people living there. The birds were pecking the vegetables in her father's garden. She made a scarecrow so like him, the neighbors passing by said, 'You're up early.' That was the first doll. To replenish the village, she made several hundred more, slowly. It took years. Like my mother, passing by the Agapanthus each morning. Ayano speaks to the dolls who don't speak back. Dolls who don't last as long as humans and other ready-mades, 3 years max. She dresses them in waterproof clothes. There are no more children in the village. Her dolls sit at the desks now or stand at the blackboard in the pose of teaching. They also fish, repair roads, wait for the bus, doze. She places them at the entrance to the valley. Valley of the shadow of what? The mouths are the hardest part to make, she says. I pull the string at the mouth and they smile. 3,000 years ago, the first scarecrows were live children who ran through fields. The next article I'll be reading is titled Between Tact and Force by Jack Black. It's from the Harper's Archive and was written in 1929. There's a lot of law at the end of a rope. Such was the gospel of the San Francisco vigilantes when they set out to clean up the crime wave of 1849. But theirs was a world of ox carts and covered wagons. Ours is one of automobiles and airplanes. So most things have moved along since then. Yet the passage of many years has made little difference in the methods with which the right people deal with the wrong. There's plenty of law at the end of a nightstick. This has the vigilante ring to it, but was spoken by a recent New York police commissioner at the outset of the cleanup campaign with which he began his tenure. The only result apparent so far is a lot of indiscriminate clubbing and shooting by the police and a corresponding increase in murders and crimes of violence. No doubt these are violent days. We are all agreed on that. The question is, who is responsible? Are the wrong people making the right people violent? Or are the right people making the wrong people violent? Is it 50-50? From my seat on the sidelines, it looks as though society were trying to outgang the gangster, outslug the slugger, and outshoot the shooter, without pausing to ask whether it won't result in simply pyramiding violence. The right people in press and pulpit are writing and preaching about the wrong ones. Individuals high and low, from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to the smallest small-town reformer, are surveying and recommending, resolving and whereasing. Legislators are legislating, while the police are pistoling and nightsticking, practicing violence as though it were the natural cure for crime. Is there any justification anywhere in any time for believing this method will work? I don't find it. Had the laws that the right people are making today been in effect 15 years ago, I should never have had a chance to stop stealing and learn working. I should probably have been stopped by the rope, the chair, or a policeman's bullet. Had I escaped these, I should be a lifer in some prison like Dannemora or Charlestown, spitting my lungs out against a whitewashed wall. I should be one of those jailbirds who perhaps had wronged society and whom society, not understanding, had wronged back with interest. My case is typical. Up to the age of 15, I thought a policeman a hero, a person to be looked up to, trusted, and confided in. Then one evening, I was mistakenly picked up, taken down, and thrown in by one of them. The treatment I got in jail from him and his fellow officers shot that illusion all to pieces. I got my first lesson in violence that night. For 25 years, I punished and was punished. I learned the game of violence thoroughly, from the police, the courts, the prisons. In the end, I came to believe that I could survive only by using violence, and I came to know hundreds of reformed criminals, but not even one who was reformed by a policeman's nightstick, a severe sentence, or prison cruelty. A brutal flogging in a Canadian prison, and years later, 3 days in a murderous straitjacket in a dungeon in California, certainly did nothing to turn my thoughts toward reformation. Meanwhile, all crooks are equal under the law in such places as England. There, the offender is neither slobbered over by a lot of sentimentalists nor clubbed into a confession by the police. There, police protection means protection of the Englishman. What is police protection coming to mean here? Here, the police-crook alliance discourages decent people and develops the latent larceny and all the rest. Yet the right people are all for bigger police forces, even as that would only multiply evil. What I am for is a better police force. By a better police force, I mean one composed of men who have a less punitive and a more scientific attitude toward crime and criminals, but surrounded by an atmosphere of grift, with little chance of promotion except through favoritism, what chance can there be for a man to do intelligent, humane, and constructive police work? From What's Wrong with the Right People, which appeared in the June 1929 issue of Harper's Magazine. The complete article, along with the magazine's entire 173-year archive, is available online at harpers.org/archive. The last column I'll be reading today is titled Findings. In 2023, the hottest year on record, the number of unprovoked shark attacks remained level, and researchers warned that as temperatures rise, humans should prepare for more diarrhea. The diurnal asymmetric warming of the Earth has reversed course since 1991, with daytime temperatures rising faster than nighttime ones. The warming of low-elevation tropical forests is driving lianas to strangle trees. The skeletons of Caribbean sea sponges may suggest that the planet surpassed 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming more than a decade ago. Depression in humans is correlated with higher body temperature, and cold water swimming mitigates menopause symptoms. H5N1 was suspected or confirmed in the deaths of such birds as black-browed albatross, brown skuas, giant petrels, kelp gulls, and Antarctic terns found at locations including Bird Island, Penguin River, Right Whale Bay, and Sea Lion Island. Anatomists examining rosy-faced lovebirds found that parrots' ability to swing by their beaks constitutes a unique form of locomotion whose long pendular periods are similar to that of gibbon brachiation. The long calls of wild-flanged male orangutans feature rhythmically isochronous call sequences nested within further isochronous call sequences. Clownfish can count the number of vertical bars on other fish. The disruptive sound in a Tampa neighborhood that was previously blamed on aliens, the military, and party boats may actually be the sound of the black drum mating. That is all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining me for this hour of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen, saying goodbye until next time.